Good morning, everyone. You're listening to the World Teacher Program for Share International New Zealand on Planet FM 104.6. Each Friday morning, we bring you information from the teachers of the Ageless Wisdom. The purpose of our program is to introduce Maitreya, the world teacher for the age of Aquarius. Maitreya does not come alone. He brings with him the Masters of Wisdom, a group of highly evolved teachers. They work in many fields and can teach us the art of living, how to live in right relationship with each other. With their inspiration, we can transform our civilization, creating justice and peace for us all.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to our program. Today's focus will be Benjamin Cram, who was the founding editor of Share International magazine and also a British artist, author, and esotericist. He was born back in 1922 and passed away in 2016. His first book was titled The Reappearance of the Christ and the Masters of Wisdom and was published in 1979. In the preface, he talks about how he came to do the work that he ended up doing. And it begins, "It will not be a complete account. There are unwritten laws of reticence on some aspects of the master-disciple relationship. But for whatever interest it may have, and in the hope that it may make more real and believable the fact of the masters and the fact of the Christ's return at their head, I set down the following. In the early 1950s, I happened on a book by Rolf Alexander titled The Power of the Mind. The magazine article which drew my attention to it had, of course, concentrated on the most sensational aspect of the book, cloud busting, the breaking up of clouds by the power of thought alone. Rolf Alexander, a Canadian, was called to Tibet and trained by a Tibetan master of yoga, and his book outlines a practice to bring the instinctive subconscious mind under the control of the directive conscious mind. The method used is self-hypnosis, the freeing of the conscious directing principle from its involvement in the activity of the subconscious mind, which should proceed automatically, releases large stores of mental energy and leads directly to the focus and concentration which precede meditation. And so I began to meditate. I also began to read. I read, among many others, the theosophical works of H.P. Blavatsky and Leadbetter, Gurdjieff, Ouspensky and Nicole, Paul Brunton, Patanjali, the Alice Bailey and Agni Yoga teachings, Swamis Vivekananda, Sivananda, Yogananda, Sri Ramana Maharshi, whose path of self-knowledge I sought to follow. And through his meditation on who am I, and I know now through the grace of my master, I found myself precipitated into a sense of identity with the whole phenomenal world, the earth, the sky, the houses and people, the trees and birds and clouds. I saw to be myself. I disappeared as a separate being, yet retained full consciousness, a consciousness expanded to include everything. I saw that this was the true reality, that one's normal waking consciousness simply covers this, keeps it hidden through wrong identification with oneself as this body. I also saw this phenomenal world as a kind of ritual, a ritualized shadow play, acting out a dream or desire of that which alone existed, alone was real, which was also myself. So how did I come into this work? In late 1958, I was told by a fellow disciple who had the connection that I was receiving messages. This surprised me, and I had no sense that it was true. I was told that the messages bounced off me, but if I did such and such in a time, I would receive correctly. I must have done the right thing, because one night early in January 1959, so clearly there was no mistaking, I heard inwardly the instruction, go to so-and-so, a place in London, on such and such a date and time, some 3 weeks ahead. On that night, there were people waiting there to meet me. That was the start of a flow of messages which came in gathering momentum. Some, apparently, I missed. I was told later when I missed one, and I became so afraid of missing them that I gave them to myself. I sent myself on several rendezvous when nothing happened and no one came, but gradually I settled down. I did not miss them, and I stopped making them up. I was told to get a tape recorder and received many long dictations of various kinds. Some contained advice, guidance, or spiritual instruction. I was not told the identity of the master or masters who spoke thus telepathically to me, and I think I was too shy to ask, although I was told I could ask questions. It was not until years later that I learned his name, and also that I would have been told had I asked long ago. One night early in 1959, during such a transmission, I was told to turn off the tape recorder. There followed a discourse on his reappearance by Maitreya, the Christ, head of our planetary hierarchy. He said also that I would have a part in the plan. At that time, I believed that the world teacher would come from one of the higher planets, probably from Venus, and this information from Maitreya caused a complete upset to my thinking. In a transmission soon after this event, my master, referring to this newfound knowledge, added, "The time is coming when you will be expected to act upon it." And in another, "Affirm his coming." On instruction, I put these tapes away for 17 years, and I'm afraid I needed a rather strong push from the master to launch me into this work. Towards the end of 1972, when I was rather in the doldrums and least expecting it, that wise and wily one, whom I have the privilege to call master, pounced. He took me in hand and subjected me to the most intensive period of de-glamorization, disillusioning, training and preparation. For months we worked together, 20 hours a day, deepening and strengthening the telepathic link until it was two-way with equal ease, requiring the minimum of his attention and energy. He forged in this period an instrument through whom he could work, and which would be responsive to his slightest impression. Of course, with my complete cooperation and without the slightest infringement of my free will. Everything I see and hear, he sees and hears. When he wishes, a look from me can be a look from him, my touch his. So, with the minimum expenditure of energy, he has a window on the world, an outpost of his consciousness. He can heal and teach. He himself remains in a full physical body thousands of miles away. I'm not suggesting that I am his only window on the world. I do not know how rare this is, but I'm sure that it is not unique. It constitutes a definite stage in the master-disciple relationship. He has asked me not to reveal his identity for the time being, not even to the members of the group with which I work and through which he works. I know of two reasons, there may be others, for his request and respect them, but I may say that he is one of the senior members of the hierarchy, a master of the wisdom, whose name is well known to esotericists in the West. His inspiration has heightened tremendously the conceptual power and intensity of my paintings. Two small episodes among many which illustrate the loving concern of the Great Ones and their lively sense of humour, as well as the ability to use their powers at long distance. The first occurred early in 1973, during the period of most intense preparation and training. For some time, I had been smoking small cigarettes, and the master frequently urged me to stop smoking these filthy weeds, as he called them. His technique of discouraging me was to assign some meditation or exercise every time I made to light one. One day, preparing to keep an appointment somewhere, I laid the small box of cigars on the corner of my bed while I changed clothes. When I was ready to leave, it had literally disappeared. I asked the master, of course, if he had done something to it. He claimed complete ignorance of or interest in the filthy weeds. I was certain of where I had left them, but nevertheless made a thorough search without result. And I repeated, "Are you sure you didn't hide them?" He swore his innocence. He had better things to do with his time and energy. At last I said, "All right, I'll just get some more on the way out." Immediately they lay on the bed corner where I had left them. The second episode concerns a bird and occurred about 2.5 years ago. Each year we are visited by large numbers of swifts who dive and wheel outside our windows all day long and nest under the eaves. Early one hot summer morning, one of these marvellous birds flew through an open bedroom window straight through the closed Venetian blind. It dropped with a thud onto a large tin of floor varnish which stood under the window. It lay there panting, its eyes staring, and its enormous wings lying awry, one on and one over the side of the tin. The master asked me to look closely and carefully over the bird, and I felt his energy pouring through my eyes. At once, it relaxed and closed its eyes. The master assured me that there were no bones broken, but that it was severely bruised and shocked. He told me to open the window and to go down and have breakfast. Half an hour later, I returned to find the bird gone, healed and restored to the morning air. These two little episodes may surprise those students who remember the Master Joao Kuo's statement that the masters are not interested in and do not concern themselves with the personality lives of disciples. While I am sure that, in general, this is true, I am equally certain that there are exceptions to this rule. It depends entirely on the type of relationship the master is seeking to build, the degree of trust he seeks to elicit, and the karmic relationship existing between himself and the disciple. Mr. Krem continues with his story. In March 1974, he gave me a list of 14 names of people to invite to a talk at my home on meditation and allied subjects. They all came. I talked about the hierarchy of masters, about meditation, and its role in bringing about soul contact. Under instruction, I presented them with the following offer. I invited them to take part in a group work in which their occult meditation would proceed under the guidance of a master of the wisdom, in exchange for which they would act as transmitters of the hierarchical energies, thus forming a bridging group between hierarchy and the disciples in the field. The master arranged a short transmission to show them what was involved. 12 of the 14 agreed, 2 feeling that they were not ready for this kind of work. The group was formed in March 1974 to channel the spiritual potencies. We met twice weekly at first for about 1.5 to 2 hours. The question of a name for the group came up, but the master's instruction was, and still is, that no name should be used, no organisation built, no offices appointed, no fence erected around ourselves and our ideas, the maximum openness maintained. The group's personnel has changed many times, only 4 of the original group remaining. Its numbers have grown and fallen, but always seem to stabilise at around 12 fully active members, with many less active or regular participants, and a great many offshoots both here and abroad. Nowadays, we meet regularly 3 times weekly to transmit the energies from hierarchy for anything from 4 to 7 or 8 hours on end. Only the most dedicated and committed people, of course, can maintain that intensity of rhythm, so numbers are necessarily kept low. In June 1974 began a series of overshadowing and transmitted messages by Maitreya, inspiring us and keeping us informed of the progress of his externalization. We were privileged also to become aware of the gradual creation and perfectionment of his body of manifestation called the Maya Varupa. Towards the end of 1974, the Master said several times, "You know, you must take all this to the public. It is of little use giving this information to the 20 or so people only who are here." The pantomime began. I would remonstrate, plead not to have to go public. He would assure me that he was only joking. "I have other plans for you," he would say, and I would relax again. But in January 1975, he finally said, "I mean it. Give this information." He had dictated a mass of information on how the plan would work out to the groups of all backgrounds and teachings. Tell them what you know. The hope is that from the more focused minds of the groups will go out a telepathic interplay with the general public, so that when you go to them, they will be somewhat prepared. I didn't like it. I didn't like it at all. I liked what I was doing. I liked working quietly, esoterically, knowing I was doing something useful, but neither too strenuous nor making too great psychological demands on me. I did nothing about the groups until several firm pushes from the Master at last got me moving. In March or April, I wrote hopefully to 40 or so groups working along spiritual lines, offering my services as a speaker on the reappearance of the Christ and the Masters of the Wisdom. In response, not surprisingly, for I was quite unknown, was not altogether overwhelming. I had, I think, about 6 or 7 replies. 3 of these groups were interested to know more, all newish groups run by young people, Centre House, Gentle Ghost, and the Franklin School, and I gave a talk at each, the first at Centre House on May 30th, 1975. I was very nervous. Although I knew my material, I did not have it in any sort of order. The Master, in his kindness, dictated for me a list of headings which I could glance at, and, in fact, so overshadowed me throughout the talk that he practically gave it. Just before the end, I was suddenly overshadowed by Maitreya himself. My heart melted, and I had the greatest difficulty in keeping my voice steady. The following words were put into my mind. When the Christ returns, he will not at first reveal his presence, nor will the Masters who precede him, but gradually steps will be taken, which will reveal to men that there lives among them now a man of outstanding, extraordinary potency, capacity for love and service, and with a breadth of view far from the ordinary. Men and women all over the world will find themselves drawn into the awareness of the point in the modern world wherein this man will live, and from that centre of force will flow the true spirit of the Christ, which will gradually reveal to men that he is with us. Those who can respond to his presence and his teaching will find themselves somewhat reflecting this love, this potency, this breadth of vision, and will go into the world and spread abroad the fact that the Christ is in the world, and that men should look to that country from which a certain teaching is emanating. This will take place in a very relatively short period of time, and will lead to conclusive evidence that the Christ is in our midst. From that time onwards, the changes which will take place in the world will proceed with a speed unprecedented in the whole history of the planet. The next 25 years will show such changes, changes so radical, so fundamental, that the world will be entirely changed for the better. No one was more surprised than I was to hear the statement. Not until I heard it back on tape was I sure even that it made sense. And that is all I can read out. There is actually another good page worth talking about Benjamin Krem's early involvement in this work. Perhaps I could finish reading it in an upcoming program. Thank you very much for listening, and wishing you all a lovely week.
Permaculture. When do I prune my roses?